Hello, ladies and germs. This is Tim Ferriss, and welcome to the brand new Tribe of Mentors podcast. For those who have no background on me, I'm an author, early stage investor in 50 plus companies like Facebook, Twitter, Uber, Alibaba, and many others, and the host of The Tim Ferriss Show, which is a long form podcast with more than 200 million downloads. Tribe of Mentors, this new gig, is an experimental podcast similar in flavor to The Tim Ferriss Show, but much shorter, much more distilled. This is season one, planned for 10 to 15 episodes. And instead of my usual 2 to 4 hour interviews, Tribe of Mentors packs a punch, or so it's intended, in, say, 10 to 30 minutes on average, and delivers tools, habits, and lessons learned from world-class performers in every field you can imagine. So you could think of this as a caffeine jolt of not just inspiration, but also tactical advice that you can use. The Tribe of Mentors podcast is largely adapted from my new book of the same name, Tribe of Mentors, subtitled Short Life Advice from the Best in the World, which details the routines, habits, tools of more than 130 people who are the best at what they do, including elite athletes like Kelly Slater and Dara Torres, legendary coaches like Dan Gable, at least a dozen billionaires and iconic investors, co-founders of companies like Facebook, Twitter, Dropbox, Craigslist, and others, poker and cryptocurrency, phenoms, and many geniuses you've never, ever heard of. In some cases, those are my favorites. And you can learn all about Tribe of Mentors at tribeofmentors.com. That's the book, or find it wherever books are sold. But let's get into the audio interview. Well, hello there, my sexy little Mogwai. This is Tim Ferriss, and welcome to a new episode of the Tribe of Mentors podcast. And this particular episode is a full audio version of an episode with James and Susie Amos Cameron. There are two other versions, and one of them is on the Tribe of Mentors podcast. It is a shorter version with three particular answers pulled out of that interview. And then there is what I might consider my personal highlights and favorites, which I've pulled out if you want to listen to a shorter version on the Tim Ferriss Show podcast, which you can find at tim.blog/podcast. But for those of you who want to dig a little deeper to hear all of what was discussed, then I suggest digging into this particular interview. And some of you may be wondering, who are James and Susie Amos Cameron? But let's go back in time to around 2009 or 2010, when I was given a t-shirt, and the t-shirt was an Avatar, as in the film, an Avatar staff t-shirt. And on the front was a quote, and the quote was, "Hope is not a strategy. Luck is not a factor. Fear is not an option." It is attributed to James Cameron, who is part of the dynamic duo who will be featured in this episode. Who's James Cameron, you ask? James Cameron is a filmmaker and deep sea explorer. He is writer, director, and producer of many films, including The Terminator, Aliens, The Abyss, Terminator 2, True Lies, Titanic, and Avatar. Both Titanic and Avatar, the highest grossing film of all time, won the Golden Globe for Best Director and Best Picture, and were nominated for a record number of awards. Cameron was also at the vanguard of the 3D renaissance, developing cutting-edge 3D camera systems. As an explorer in 2012, Cameron set the world's solo deep diving record of 35,787 feet in the Challenger Deep in a vehicle of his own design. He is a dedicated environmentalist, and he has founded the Avatar Alliance Foundation to take action on climate change, energy policy, deforestation, indigenous rights, ocean conservation, and sustainable agriculture. He's currently in production on Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5. You can find him on Twitter at Jim Cameron. Susie Amos Cameron, his wife, is a noted environmental advocate, mother of five, and the author of OMD, which is One Meal a Day. OMD, subtitled The Simple Plant-Based Program to Save Your Health, Save Your Waistline, and Save the Planet, and the founder of the OMD Movement, a multi-pronged effort to transform eating habits and the food system. She is also founder of Plant Power Task Force, focused on showing the impact of animal agriculture on climate change and the environment, founded in 2012 with her husband, that is Jim, and Craig McCaw. In 2005, she founded Muse School, the first school in the country to be 100% solar powered with zero waste and a 100% organic plant-based lunch program. Additionally, she is founder of Verdient Foods, Cameron Family Farms and Food Forest Organics, along with Red Carpet Green Dress. As an actor, she's been featured in more than 25 films, including The Usual Suspects and Titanic. You can find her online, Facebook, Susie A. Cameron, that's Susie, S-U-Z-Y, Twitter, Susie Musing, and Instagram, Susie Amos Cameron. All right, so some of you who are long-term listeners have no doubt heard multiple guests on to discuss the ketogenic diet, to discuss alternate approaches to food and health. And I thought that this episode would be a good opportunity to give some airtime to discussion of plant-based diets. And it should also be underscored that there are chapters in the 4-Hour Body, two of them with the legendary ultra-endurance athlete Scott Jurek about plant-based diets. And even if you disagree with perhaps plant-based diets or any of the arguments you might hear from Susie and James, I'd suggest listening for at least three reasons. Number one, there's plenty of non-plant talk, and we jump right into it with discussion of how they both respond to feeling overwhelmed or distracted. The second is patience. In this podcast, I do my best to, in a gentle way, sometimes not so gentle, but often a gentle way, expose people to different viewpoints, different perspectives in the world, which is why I have on very often, for instance, someone who's highly religious like Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, and then I will have just a few episodes later someone like Sam Harris, who is PhD in neuroscience and very well known for being an atheist. I might have someone who is far left and then someone who is far right, because I like to focus on some of the commonalities and also the thought processes. The only way you can understand your argument, your position best, is to also understand the opposing viewpoints. All right, so that's number two. This is an exercise in patience, especially in these divisive times. I think it is a worthwhile exercise. And third, OMD, one meal per day that is plant-based. I would recommend, even if you don't plan on converting to fully plant-based, as a consciousness practice and an exercise, which is something I very often do. I will impose certain constraints on my eating, eliminate a certain food product, or I will insist that I eat based on a spectrum of color as a way to make my subconscious or automatic behaviors, i.e. eating, more conscious so that I'm more aware of what I am doing and the decisions I am making. So those are a few of the many reasons I would suggest listening to this. And without further ado, let's just jump right into it with Susie and James Cameron.
All right. So our first question that we're going to answer, besides your own, what is the book or books you've given most as a gift and why, or what are one to three books that have greatly influenced your life?
Well, we give a lot of books as presents because we're always evangelizing and proselytizing for plant-based nutrition and for the environment and sustainability and things like that. Susie every year makes up a gift bag, right, on a theme, but usually the theme is around sustainability, and there are always some books in there. So we give out a lot of books.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of books.
Right. So the publisher of the China Study, for example, probably noticed a big uptick in sales about the year that we decided to send all our friends the China Study and Forks Over Knives. So I think this happens a lot with plant-based eaters, that they become kind of like born-again, you know, Christians. They want to share the good news with everybody, so they become insufferable for the first year or so.
Yes, we were, definitely. And people would see us coming, and they would turn around and run the other way.
But... yeah, waddle the other way. if they follow our advice, they can run.
Exactly. But I think we've gotten a little more tactful in our approach. I think the other book that I've been giving out a lot is The Cheese Trap by Dr. Neil Barnard.
Sure, because you hear so much. Everybody says, you know, so many people say, well, I think I could do it. I could give up meat. Yeah, no problem. But I don't see how I can give up cheese.
Oh, it's the hardest thing to give up.
And that book is so great at showing, you know, why it is a trap, why it's basically an addiction.
Right. So dairy, actually, all mammals have naturally occurring opiates in their breast milk for a reason, because it keeps the baby coming back to nurse so that it will thrive. But if you think about a human baby growing from 7 pounds to 18 pounds in a year, and then you think of a cow growing from 60 pounds to 600 pounds in a year, you're getting that much more, more opiates. And you think about, so you're just having a glass of milk or cream in your coffee, but you have yogurt and it's condensed that down even more.
And cheese is condensed even further. So it's sort of bioconcentrating the natural occurring opiates.
And it's like a block of morphine. So yeah, dairy's really difficult to give up. But there's so many alternatives now, way more than there were 6.5 years ago when we went plant-based.
Yeah. So the alternative cheeses, they're not, the nut-based cheeses, cashew-based and so on.
Miyoko's.
Are getting pretty good, and you can cook with them, and they have the same texture and mouthfeel and cookability and things like that. And that's all just within the last couple of years, I think. So there isn't, I can't think of a cheese dish that you can't duplicate pretty well entirely from plant sources now. Of course, you're not getting your opiates.
Exactly.
But then you don't want to be a heroin addict either.
No, but you've got a natural high from eating plants already. So
yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, that makes up for it. Oh,
exactly.
Good, baby. That was nice. Yeah. but, in terms of books, I mean, I think we're supposed to answer more broadly than just about our utter fixation with plant-based nutrition. Another book that I've shared a lot is Sapiens, which is an incredible book. It's got nothing to do with plant-based nutrition. It's just an amazing book. It explains human behavior and why we are the way we are and human civilization from soup to nuts. And it's I've read it now a couple of times. It's a pretty astonishing book.
Yeah.
So I'm recommending that.
Yeah, I think there's another book that I recommended so often, which was Arianna Huffington's book, Thrive.
Yeah.
Really, really, I mean, her journey of burning herself out and realizing how important sleep and self-care were. And it kind of gives you license to take care of yourself in a world that, people think that overachievers are, type A, triple type A, that you need to be that way to succeed. So that's actually a really
well.
Great
you do
book
to
too.
An extent, but you've got to be able to go the distance. So you got to pace yourself. And long term success is definitely about pacing yourself. And if I'm going to loop it back to our favorite topic, no, I mean the kind of energy and stamina and recovery that you get from being a whole food plant based eater.
Right.
It's what's gotten me through a year of production. I've never done a year of production in my life. Titanic took 6 months to shoot. We just finished a year because we did Avatar 2 and Avatar 3 back-to-back. And that was one solid year of production. And, I'm feeling great.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I'd be completely burned out after a six-month shoot and require a month to recover.
Well, you got sick a lot on the first one.
Yeah, I got sick on Avatar. I got sick on Titanic. And since we went plant-based 6.5 years ago, I mean, I literally haven't been sick at all, like zero.
Right.
Not even a sniffle or a cough or a sore throat, nothing.
Right.
Well, so, it works.
Certainly being on the road and selling my new book, I know that it's giving me an edge to be able to, pop back and forth between different time zones and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
On top of being a mom of five and
yeah,
running school. And
to truthfully answer the question, you can't plug your own book, though. Because you said,
oh,
what
right.
book besides your own?
Oh, right. Sorry.
All right. So what's the next question?
Okay. We're going to the next question now. How has a failure or apparent failure set you up for later success? Do you have a favorite failure of yours?
Oh, well, I don't think I can answer that question because I've never failed at anything. No, well, I've been lucky on my directed films. I've only had one that underperformed, and that was The Abyss. That wasn't a hit. I've had produced films that didn't do well, and certainly learned from those. But the film, my film that I would consider a failure because it wasn't a hit. It was sort of a break-even project. It was quite big in its day. It was considered, I think, probably one of the most expensive films ever made in its time, although it's nothing by present standards, was The Abyss, which was released in 1989. And I think I learned some strong lessons from that about the craft of shaping a story in post-production and maximizing it. And even in the writing, you know, I learned that, you know, from that film that the emotional peak came well before the ending, and then the ending was this kind of ambitious visual overreach. I think I couldn't have made Titanic, and Titanic wouldn't have been a hit if I hadn't done The Abyss. Because on Titanic, I kept the abyss in mind, and I shaped it to have the maximum emotional orchestration to the end of the film, and to keep the visual effects in check, so that they always served the storyline, served the narrative, and served the characters. So it took The Abyss failing for Titanic to be the success that it was. I think I don't mean commercial success, but artistic success. Mm-hmm. Let's say. So yeah, you have to. It's all a journey. I mean, filmmaking is a journey. Every film itself is a journey, but then across the films, the kind of meta narrative that runs across the films is also a journey.
Right, right. Well, I think you know, you always hear failing forward, and certainly when the school that I founded with my sister Rebecca Amos, we founded a school called Muse School, and we decided in January of 14 that we were going to take the school plant-based because it's an environmental school, and we couldn't call ourselves an environmental school and still be serving animal products.
Yeah, it'd be like you know, driving a Humvee to work.
Yeah.
Calling yourself an environmentalist. It just seemed like such a cognitive dissonance to us that
exactly.
we had to stand for something.
Yeah, definitely. So we decided to take the school plant-based and promptly created a mutiny. We lost 50% of our families, and I thought the school was going to close.
I didn't think it
was going to succeed, and
yeah.
It was really nerve-wracking, and, you know, but it just felt like the right thing to do. And ultimately, in the end, we regained our enrollment very quickly, and we've now surpassed it, and families move from all over the United States. We even have a couple of families that have moved from out of country to move to Calabasas to come to the school because it's environmental, because it's passion and interest-based learning, because it's plant-based. So it's really about, you know, trusting your instinct and your gut and doing the right thing, doing something that you think is going to make a difference in
life.
Well,
we talked about it before we did it. And I think the final conclusion was, you know, screw it. If it tanks the school, it tanks the school. But you got to stand on your principles.
Because if you don't stand for something, you fall for everything.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, and the thing is that you approach the problem very systematically, and you had you set a timetable to do it that was more than a year out, and you brought in speakers. You had a speaker series, and you had town halls, and brought the parents in, and included them or tried to. But the people, when you talk to people about their food, it's like talking to them about religion or you know, partisan politics.
It is.
People get very entrenched in their belief systems, and their identity sort of becomes defined by their beliefs.
Yeah.
And they'd rather die than be wrong. They'd rather be unhealthy than be wrong. Or they'd rather have their kids be unhealthy than be wrong.
Yeah, and it's true.
You know,
we took 18 months to educate everyone, and we really went at it from every different angle. So we brought in doctors, we brought in climate scientists, we brought in chefs, we brought in athletes, we brought in authors, we brought in animal rights people. And they would spend the day with the children, and then at the end of the day, we would bring the adults in, give them a glass of wine and some beautiful plant-based delicious food. And even after all of that, we still had pushback.
Well, it was seen as a top-down push, you know.
Yeah.
Even though you were trying to get buy-in. And I think a lot of that experience, probably, if you're talking about failing forward, not only did the school prosper as a result, but if I can swing this back around to your book, I don't think you would have written OMD the way you did, as inclusively as you did, if you hadn't gone through that experience, because you realize how people are entrenched in a belief system that's enculturated. We all grew up with it. Our parents taught us, their grandparents taught them, you know. Meat for strength, milk for bones and teeth and all that sort of thing.
Well, that's a good point, because what ended up happening, you know, after all of the work that we had done to try to educate people and really give them a way into it, our head of school, Jeff King, got very frustrated one day with the parents, and he said, "People, you can give them eggs and bacon in the morning, and you can give them a burger at night. It's one meal a day. It's OMD." And so that's where OMD came from. It was born there, and that's when I took that idea and wrote a book around the idea of it.
Are you down with OMD?
Exactly.
Yeah, but it's great. I mean, because it's inclusive, because it understands that people, I think they fall into two categories. You've got very close-minded people that won't even listen. And then you've got people that have actually read enough and heard enough to realize that it would be beneficial to them, but don't think they can do it, but are curious about it, maybe want to try it. And the great thing about OMD is that, you know, it's one meal a day, and if you make that pledge, not only are you cutting your carbon footprint and your environmental footprint significantly, but you're starting to feel some delta. There's going to be some change in the way that you feel and in your health and so on. And you get to see how relatively easy it is. And it's not that big a deal. The fear of it is greater than the actual process of doing it.
Well, and I think that's why it's a non-judgmental, it's not about perfection. It's just one meal, and realizing that how empowering it is for one person to be able to make a difference in, you know, your carbon footprint and your water footprint. So one person eating one plant-based meal for 1 year saves 200,000 gallons of water and the carbon equivalent of driving from Los Angeles to New York. And people don't realize that animal agriculture is the second leading cause of greenhouse gases, more than all transportation combined. So you can make more of a difference for the environment by what you're putting on your plate than the kind of car you're driving.
Yeah. I mean, look, electrification of transportation system is critical in the long run, just like changing to renewable energy is critical. But these are things that take time, and something you can do immediately, instantaneously. You don't have to be able to afford to buy a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid. Just change what you eat. It's very simple. It brings the power back to the individual.
Right.
Now you know you're kind of living right with nature, you know, that you're not one of the millions of people that's responsible for cutting down an acre of rainforest a second in Brazil, which is what's happening right now to make room for cropland. Everybody thinks, well, you know, why is the footprint, the environmental footprint, so high for cattle? It's not what the cattle are eating. It's not the water that the cattle are drinking so much. It's the fact that so much deforestation and sort of misuse of land is taking place to grow crops to feed the cattle. Whereas the efficiency factor for humans eating the grains and the plants directly is depending on where the cattle are growing and who the people are and all that sort of thing, it ranges from 20 to 40 times more efficient in terms of land use. I mean, if everybody on Earth eats the way we do collectively here in the U.S., were to do that, and our population continues to grow to 9 billion as is projected by 2050, we need four planet Earths.
Right.
We're already way into overshoot. We're already way past sustainability already with the number of people we have and with the number of people that are still not eating the way we do.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sort of a social justice aspect to it as well. If you think about it, those people that don't eat like us can't eat like us. It will not be allowed by the laws of nature.
Right.
So we're basically, you know, there's a social justice issue to this, in addition to the environmental issue and the animal rights issue and all that. So that's on the negative side. But on the positive side, the thing that's great about this is not only is your health going to improve, but your if you're an athlete or even just a casual athlete, play tennis, whatever, your performance is going to improve.
Yeah, absolutely. Greatly. Next question. What are bad recommendations you hear in your profession or area of expertise?
Well, the one recommendation that I hear all the time that's given to kids and everything is do what you love. And I would modify that strongly. Do what you love. That is also something people will pay you for.
Right. Which is what you have found out how to do.
Yeah, right.
Very successfully.
I get to do what I love because I love making films. I love all the things that I spend time on, exploration and all that. People don't pay you to be an explorer. No, I can say that. You go do something that you love and make money. Then you go get to do something you love that people won't pay you for, like deep ocean exploration, because there is no money in that game whatsoever. What other recommendation? Well, I mean, look, in our, the question was, your profession or field of expertise. So we know a lot about plant-based nutrition. So I'm going to vector it back to that.
I have certification through Equinel.
Yeah, that's right. You're a certified nutritionist.
Yeah.
So many bad recommendations in nutrition.
Yeah.
And doctors make them. All the time. Doctors tell you to build yourself up by eating meat.
It's like, not their fault either. It's just the way they've been trained.
Or not trained because they don't study nutrition. I mean, I was talking to a doctor the other day. He's on a cardiology path. He's still in university. I said, how much nutritional training have you had? Because I had said in a public speaking thing, they only get about somewhere between an hour and a day total of nutritional training through 7 years of med school. And he said, about an hour.
That's crazy.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, doctors are myth propagators these days, the myth that you need meat for protein. In fact, interestingly enough, the great vast majority of doctors conflate the term protein and meat.
Right.
Like it is one thing.
Yeah.
Certainly meat is a source of protein. It's about all that's in it besides protein and fat, as opposed to plants being a source of protein and a source of minerals and phytonutrients and micronutrients of all kinds and trace elements and all sorts of stuff.
But people don't think that protein is in vegetables. I mean, there's protein in iceberg lettuce.
Where did the cow get it?
Exactly.
It's pretty simple, you know.
Right.
So, you know, the truth with animal proteins is that it's not just that they're inefficient for the environment and that they come packaged with an awful lot of fat, but that the actual biomolecular structure of the protein is not healthy for humans. And I know there are probably a lot of paleo eaters in the audience for this podcast, but we all tend to live in a confirmation bias kind of environment where we seek out the information that confirms what we want to know. But I would encourage them to look into what plant-based nutritionists are saying about meat proteins and what real paleoanthropologists are saying about what ancient humans ate. But we're not adapted for a diet of meat. We can eat meat. Meat was a killer app back in the Ice Age when the plants were covered by snow all the time. You could die out if you were a vegetarian. And when we collectively, the human species, migrated up into northern Europe, which was, where they didn't have any competition. There was plenty of competition in Africa. As you started to move up into northern Europe, you got into virgin territory, and that's why we migrated up there and lost our melanin, got pale-skinned and learned to adapt to the cold and all that stuff. You weren't going to make it through the winter if you were 100% plant-based, which is why you don't have a lot of gorillas in Scotland,
mm-hmm. Right, right.
So, yeah, it was a killer app. It allowed the expansion of the human species, but we weren't adapted and initially evolutionarily selected to do it. That's a more recent kind of thing.
Well, I think the other myth, too, is that, men really feel like they need, that meat protein in order to be manly. And you just had great success showing Game Changers to your whole crew down on the set of Avatar because it's full of elite male athletes. It's got female athletes in there
interject.
As well.
The Game Changers is a film that Susie and I just executive produced that mm-hmm. was directed by Luis Cihoyos. It's not out yet, but we think it's going to make a profound difference in this kind of male myth of meat proteins. But anyway, go, carry on.
Sweetie. Yeah, because it's you know, men believe that they need the meat to be manly, and it's quite the antithesis. Well, and you saw an unbelievable reaction with your crew. You're the set of Avatar is actually the first plant-based catered set ever. And so yeah. they're doing one meal a day and saving an enormous amount of water and
yeah, we
carbon.
give them great food. It's about 200 people between our technical team and our production group and so on.
But now it's like there's a line out the door since
well,
you
yeah,
showed the movie.
Well, yeah, it was hysterical movie. Because, you know, a year ago we went plant-based on the production because we wanted to be the greenest production ever, and we have our own solar power. We have a 1 megawatt solar power facility on the roof. And the idea was, you know, I sat the whole team down and said, guys, if we're going to make these films that stand for something about the environment and our relationship with nature, we have to walk the walk. So we're going to do a green set. And the way to do a green set is the same way Susie did the green school. So we're going to go one meal a day. We're going to eat plant-based for our lunch, and that's what we're going to cater. And, you know, it wasn't a dictatorship. People could always go across the street to any of the many restaurants in the area, fast food joints in the area. It's in an urban area. We're not out in the woods. But if you want to eat the free food, then it's going to be plant-based. And hopefully you'll see that it can be not only, you know, nourishing, but fun and yummy. And, you know, we'll have Thai noodles and we'll have lasagna and we'll have pizza and we'll have all the stuff you love. It just will be from plant-based sources. So they've done that for a year. But, you know, I mean, it dropped down to where, you know, maybe we'd only have like half attendance at lunch. The day we screened Game Changers and everybody was asked to show up, we did it on company time, that lunch, they ran out of food because everybody showed up. We
right.
had so many converts after seeing that film. And at least 20 people have come to me in the week since and said, I've made the decision. I'm doing this. I'm going plant-based. Or I'm going to do a 21-day challenge. Or I'm a week in and I feel great. You know, all that stuff. Of course, it's all anecdotal. But, I mean, if we'd thought about it, we could have done a before and after study, a proper scientific study, because we've
oh,
got
right.
a big enough cohort. We've got a couple hundred people.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, I know that the chefs are happy with, you know, everybody lining up to eat the yummy food, and it is. It's delicious. Next question?
Next question.
Okay. In the last 5 years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
Can we stretch the envelope to 6.5 years? Because that's how long we've been plant-based.
I know. Well, I was planning on doing that anyway because that it's been, I mean, it absolutely changed our lives.
Yeah.
You know, not only from a health point of view, but understanding the whole environmental impact. But it's also affected what our investments are and everything that we
sure.
do, every
yeah.
decision that we make, every request that we have goes through that lens of plant-based eating.
Sure. Like we built a factory up in Canada. It's a company called Verdient that makes plant-based proteins from yellow peas and lentils. That's one of the largest dry protein processing plants in Canada. So that was an investment decision that was guided by our kind of epiphany.
Right. And now we're using those plant proteins to actually work with the food center
in Saskatchewan,
at the University of Saskatchewan and create food products. So I'm going to be rolling out OMD food products in early 19. They're making things like ginger beef and pulled pork and cheeses and pasta sauces and snacks.
Yeah, so there'll be a whole OMD line, a whole bunch of different SKUs
yeah.
on that. So yeah, so it has had a profound impact on us, and that was one single change, habit change, behavior change.
Right. I mean, it's completely, I know that I have certainly found my purpose in life, and it's what propelled me to write a book, mm-hmm. and which has completely changed the trajectory of what I was doing. I was going, you know, into
education
and schools. But interestingly enough, it has fed into that because now Muse School is being launched worldwide, Muse Global. And all of those schools will be OMD schools. They'll all have the same philosophy that we carry at Muse Prime.
Well, it's resonated beautifully because the Muse School cafeteria was voted the greenest restaurant in the world. So apparently there's a competition for the world's greenest restaurant, and all the big snooty urban seat-to-table restaurants all, you know, hope to win, and this little humble elementary school cafeteria beat them all by like 400 points because the school's solar powered and all the produce is grown, or most of the produce is grown on site, and the building was built out of repurposed building materials. It's like you literally ticked every box, you know, just by kind of walking the walk, and because it's plant-based, so it's got a 100% plant-based eater has one-third of the carbon footprint of a standard American diet eater, meaning a meat eater.
Right. Yeah.
So you kicked their butts.
Yeah, we did. But it was, we had three out of four stars for a long time, but when we went plant-based, it just really jettisoned us out, you know, and we beat the restaurant in Chicago.
We're not going to name names, but they're all high-end.
Exactly. All right. So next question.
Sure.
Okay. When you feel overwhelmed or unfocused or have lost your focus temporarily, what do you do? If helpful, what questions do you ask yourself?
So what do I do when I feel overwhelmed? I clean off my desk. Because I'm working at a high pace, you know, everything piles up. And just the act of cleaning off my desk is like a reset. It's like power cycling a computer. It's a reboot. And I usually find that about half the stuff that's accumulated I can throw out.
Mm-hmm.
And the other half I have to put in piles. You know, I have to put them in the right place. So now I'm prioritizing. Now I'm thinking, oh, well, that's still important. So I think that, you know, that if you're a team leader, you've got to get your own priorities straight before you can generate priorities for the team. And I've found that whenever I hit one of those moments, I also find it's great to take a day off, or even half a day off. Just force yourself to take a day off, not to go play, but to just reorganize.
Right.
And just, you know, kind of write down the series of priorities or kind of memos to yourself. And out of that, I typically will generate things that I hand out to my team to give them their marching orders to kind of get us back on track. And it's amazing how things just pop into focus and solutions present themselves, because mm-hmm. I haven't stopped running. I haven't gotten off the treadmill until that moment to lift my head out of the day-to-day battle to think about, well, how are we going to really win this war?
Right.
You know, something like a big film production is like a campaign that takes place over sometimes a period of years. And if you don't take a moment out to kind of look at the big picture, so most of the major strategic decisions that I've made during the productions of the two Avatar films so far over the last couple of years have come from that down day,
right,
that catch-up day. It's not about taking a day off, taking a nap. That's a good idea too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, go swim or play with the kids or whatever. You got to do that too. But just take a day for yourself with no distractions to just get everything in order. That helps me a lot. If nothing else, I just feel better about it.
Right.
I come in, there's a clean desk, here's some memos, you guys go do the work.
Well, I think we're really similar on that. I mean, I have a tendency to walk through the house and get ridiculously overwhelmed with, you know, all the kids and the cats and the dogs and the bearded dragon and the people. And
yeah.
So I always like to go in and just reorganize the house, but I always start with my office as well. Mm-hmm. And I like to take a big piece of typing paper and write out, you know, I create columns and I write out all my emails that I need to do and all my calls that I need to do. And then there's a whole section in there just for household things.
Lists
and
are
work
good.
Things and all of those. And, you know, I know that the children are learning this as well, because when they, you know, of course they roll their eyes when I walk in and say, okay, we're gonna take a clean day, an organizing day, and here's some boxes for giveaways. They roll their eyes. But in the end, they love it and they feel better. And
yeah, they get into it.
And they get into it. So it's the same sort of thing. And taking a walk and then realizing, like, okay, what is the first thing I can do that's going to get me on that journey of towards my goal, but always keeping that goal in mind of whatever that is.
You know, sometimes the best way to solve a problem is to walk away from it for a second.
Yeah.
It's counterintuitive for us type A types that just bash our heads against the problem all day long. Boom, boom, boom,
right.
boom.
We're you know,
AAA. Day after day. You know, I had an epiphany while I was writing Avatar. I was working down in New Zealand and my office was kind of in the country and you know, it was just impossible to solve some of the dramatic problems. I couldn't solve it. I couldn't fix the script. And I was sitting, I just walked away, I sat down, sat outside, and there was a glass cover to the veranda, and I watched this big fly, and he was trying to get out, and he was banging against the glass. And he just kept hitting the glass over and over and over and over, because that's how his little chip was programmed. You go toward the light, you go toward the sky. And he couldn't get to the sky. All he had to do was drop down, fly 3 feet sideways, and come out. But he couldn't process it. And I thought, how often am I that fly? How often is there some higher level of perspective that I lack in my chip that I'm missing, that is so simple that some fourth dimensional being could look at the problem and go, oh, you idiot, you just drop down, go over 3 feet, and you're out. But the fly couldn't do it. And I thought, well, what am I not seeing, you know? And that's when I went back to first principles, and I looked at the whole thing from a higher level. I got out of the trenches for that moment, and that's how I solved the problem.
Yeah, I think also too is learning when to recognize when you're hitting that window, and also learning to recognize when it's the path of least resistance, because you know you're on the right path. When doors just continue to open
well,
up.
That's true. That's the opposite. That's the other thing. It's important to recognize when things are breaking your way, when you have momentum, when you're not hitting the glass, you take advantage of it.
Right.
And you ride that tailwind.
But there's a difference, too. It's when you know you want to do something and you feel really strongly about it and you have a lot of people around you saying no you shouldn't do it and it's going to be too hard. And that, I mean, I know it works for you that way, but I mean, that just lights an inferno under my butt. It's like, okay, really? No? Watch me.
Yeah, I'd love to say that to my team on Avatar. Oh, well, we shouldn't do that, guys, because that's going to be hard.
Exactly.
when they know coming in, when they sign up, that it's going to be the most difficult production in human history by its nature, where every blade of grass in the entire world that we're creating is created by somebody, by a computer artist or by some kind of algorithm that's self-growing or whatever. You know, by definition, it's going to be hard.
Right.
You're there because it's hard. You're doing it because it's hard, you know? That's because that's how you measure yourself against that challenge. And that's why everybody's that's on the Avatar team is there, because they know it's going to be the hardest motherfucker they ever work on.
Yeah.
And they want that. Now, they'll all go whine about it later and say, that was the hardest motherfucker I ever worked on. And that's why I have this reputation as a cruel taskmaster. But in fact, they've all showed up because they want to do that. They want to climb that mountain.
And they've learned from it. I mean, that's how the teachers at Muse, they're teaching in a way they've never, nobody teaches that way. And it's really challenging.
Yeah, and
they learn.
Yeah, the kids don't like holidays because they don't get to go to school.
If you could have one gigantic billboard anywhere with anything on it, metaphorically speaking, getting a message out to millions or billions, what would it say and why? Could be a few words or a paragraph. If helpful, it can be someone else's quote. Are there any quotes you can think of or live your life by?
Yeah, I'm terrible with quotes and, you know, that sort of thing. But I think I would sum up philosophically what I would ask people to do, which is to live in a more connected way, to see yourself as part of a big global system and know that every action you take has a consequence. Every choice you make as a consumer whether it's, you know, using plastics or using electricity or replacing that iPhone that's only 6 months old because there's a better one, that has an impact on somebody somewhere or some animal somewhere or some ecosystem somewhere that, you know, when I look at the history of the human race up until now, and this all doesn't go on the billboard, by the way. I'm going to try to condense this down. But I look at the history up till now. We've been all about expansion. It's an endless hunger to conquer and expand, and we've filled the planet. We're like a bacterial culture that rapidly expands to the edge of the petri dish. Well, we're hitting the edge of the petri dish now. And so everything that always worked throughout human history is not going to work going forward. We're going to have some fundamental change in the way we think. We're going to have to stop being takers and start being caretakers, or we won't survive. It's that simple. Now, maybe it's 50 years, maybe it's 100 years, maybe it's 200 years, but it's not going to go on the way it's been going on, and we're going to have to change. And I think it's a change for the better. It's a change that's more empathic. It's more compassionate. So I guess I would say stop being a taker, or take less and caretake more. And I mean that very generally as well. Think about how decisions that you make and things you do are affecting people in other countries. You know, all those people that are coming up in that big caravan, a lot of them have been displaced by drought. Their farms have collapsed and they can't grow their food. It's not just about drug violence and all that sort of thing. Especially in Guatemala, there are you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people on the move from farms that have collapsed due to unprecedented drought that's drier conditions than they've ever had in recorded history. And the ability of science to look back hundreds of thousands of years, well, that's climate change at work. And if that particular series of droughts is not caused specifically by climate change, it's a pretty damn good bellwether for what it's going to look like when hundreds of thousands and then ultimately hundreds of millions of people are on the move because of climate change. So the choices that we're making in our energy consumption, in our consumption of natural resources, in our consumption of foods is impacting other people in other parts of the world. It'll eventually come back to haunt us with the kinds of political systems that are now taking over the world, these protectionist, isolationist, nationalistic, hyper-nationalistic, populist systems that are about closing borders and shutting down and all that sort of thing. I see it all interlinked, and I see it all as a feedback loop that's just going to get worse and worse. So I would say we have to change this from the inside out, from the way we view the world and our place in it. And stop being a taker, start being a caretaker.
Right.
That's my billboard.
When you're talking about the timeline, the United Nations just came out a couple of weeks ago with a report and from the IPCC saying that we have to do something by 2030 to turn things around if we are going to survive on this earth. And, you know, one of the things that I really resonate with is the Native American tribes, the First Nations. They always say, no matter what you're doing, realize that it's going to affect the next 7 generations. So just being really conscious in your everyday actions and tread lightly on the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look, we all struggle to do it, and we're we don't want to come off as holier than thou. That's the thing about vegans in general, is they all they're all such, you know, assholes.
Tell your joke.
Okay, how many vegans does it take to screw in a light bulb? Doesn't matter. We're better than you.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So, you know, so the problem is people tend to reject what what we could tell them.
Right.
But I think the answer to that is say, oh, well, don't take our word for it. Read the books. It's all online. The problem is that people tend to entrench around their belief systems. And now with digital news the way it is, we can pre-select the inputs. We can pre-select our inputs to support only what we already believe. And so everybody lives in these kind of isolated echo chambers, you know, and it's all exacerbated by social media and so on. And so it's really going to be another thing that we're going to have to just get a whole lot better at as a species and as a society, is checking our facts and looking at alternative opinions, and especially look at the facts that the other guys have, if they have any.
Yeah.
See, I just did a little confirmation bias swerve at the end there. Yeah, if
we're
they have any.
Need you to.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. All right. So next question. What are you currently most excited about?
All right. I'm not going to talk about plant-based nutrition.
Okay.
Other than to say for 1 second that I was pretty hopeless about being able to get a handle on climate change, just looking at it from an energy perspective and transportation and all that. And when I realized the environmental connection from eating plant-based, I got excited about that. But that's kind of old news because that's 6 years ago for us. I guess right now I'm excited about the Avatar films. I have the coolest job in the world. I get to go in and create a world, an ecosystem populated with creatures and cool characters, and do that all day long. And, you know, live in that fantasy world. So, yeah, I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, so just to piggyback on, you know, feeling hopeful, because I am going to talk about plant-based eating. Jim actually has a T-shirt, and one of the lines on it says, "Hope is not a strategy." And he's a doomsday kind of guy. If you watch his movies, they're kind of like the end of the world, apocalyptic. And he never used the word hope. And 6.5 years ago, we were walking on the beach, and he said to me, "For the first time in my life, I feel hopeful." And needless to say, I almost, you know, fell into the surf. But it's planted a seed, you know, that the more people we can inspire to eat plant-based, the more we can move the needle on climate change. And it was that seed that was planted that made me think about creating content and writing a book. And I'm most excited about the book.
Because, about your book.
About my book.
You get to be excited about your book.
So it's OMD, Changing One Meal a Day for the Planet. And it starts out with the education of the health. I worked with a brain trust of doctors, so it's very, very heavily researched in the medical field around plant-based eating. And then I worked with people from Chatham House and Oxford University and Loma Linda, climate scientists, to help me with the environmental impacts of animal agriculture. And then it's a guide. It's a guide of how to do one meal a day or two meals a day, or blow up your kitchen like Jim and I did and go cold turkey. It has recipes, shopping lists, meal plans. And I'll hold your hand. I won't judge you. It's not about being perfect. You can keep your burger if you want to. It's just about one meal a day. OMD.
All right. So I think there's one more question. Sorry.
There is one more question. If you had a request, an ask, or suggestion for the listeners of this podcast, what would it be?
Oh, I think people that listen to Tim and his guests are looking for hacks to make their life better, to learn how to live in this perplexing world and live better and kind of be smarter. So I think that, you know, I would just say read a lot, check your facts, and, you know, don't follow us because we're so sweet and compelling. Check the facts.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's all out there. But I would say also be willing to look outside your confirmation bias bubble. And I force and challenge myself to do this all the time, to get outside that bubble. And so, you know, whatever your beliefs are, ask yourself, one, where they came from. When did you double down on that? And what have you done to look at it sort of from an objective point of view? And, you know, I try to do that as much as possible. When something comes along that I don't understand, that doesn't fit my belief system, like, you know, let me just give an example, like Alan Savory's approach to regenerative agriculture with, you know, grass-fed beef and all the claims that were made around that. I looked into it. And I thought, wow, maybe there's something here. And I went pretty far down the rabbit hole on that before and looked at the science on both sides of it and ultimately saw that it wasn't the right answer, but I didn't just reject it out of hand because it didn't fit my belief system.
Right. Well, I think my ask would be to take the OMD pledge.
There you go.
And pledge one meal a day or two meals a day or go all in because it'll help your health, it'll help the planet, it'll help the animals, your waistline, and your sex life.
Yes.
Yes.
Not necessarily in that order.
Anyway, thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.
This was really fun. And thanks for having us on.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, guys. Tim Ferriss again. If you enjoyed this, just a little taste of this guest, then you will love Tribe of Mentors. The book, subtitle Short Life Advice from the Best in the World, which details the routines, habits, and tools of more than 130 people who are the best at what they do. And you can pick and choose. It is a choose-your-own-adventure buffet, but you have just about everyone imaginable. And you can find free chapters, the full list of mentors at tribeofmentors.com and wherever books are sold. So take a look, tribeofmentors.com.